It's been a while since you put me on the shelf. I know you've been distracted by somebody else. It's been a while, but that's all right, you see. And I'll be right here waiting when you want to play again with me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Cult of the Old. I am your host for this week, Nate Owens, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Ian McAllister.
Hello, Nate. How you doing?
Doing well. And Matt Thrower. How are you, Matt?
Hello, I'm good. I'm good and pleased to be here. Excited for this week's shenanigans.
This is an exciting one because you see, each episode, I and my fellow hosts are going to dive into the tabletop gaming past. We are going to turn back the release schedule at least 10 years to look at games that were setting tables ablaze in the dim and distant past of a whole decade ago, or decades ago, as is the case this week. I am your host this week. We are rotating the chair this season, and this is my first crack at it. So I like this feeling of power that I have.
I think we'll reveal it later. It's all right.
Yeah. I think I can get used to it. Yeah.
There's an argument coming up. We know there's an argument coming up where you can wield your mighty banhammer.
Exactly. Well, what are we looking at in this cast? Within any subculture, any hobby, there are certain things that become the boogeyman. Films that are so terrible, they just become the poster child for the worst that the form has to offer. Books that are so ponderous that no one can make them to the end, and everyone wonders why anybody bothers trying. Board games are not immune from this. And it is, of course, those games that a lot of us grew up with that become the target of our ire. That does not mean they're not worthwhile discussing. And here on Cult of the Old, we want to take a look at the history and impact of one of those pariahs. Yes, it's time to choose if you want to be the dog or the hat, to hope you don't go to jail, and see if you can get the best value properties. The game that makes capitalism fun, a little indie darling called Monopoly. All right, gentlemen, one of us has to do a one-minute breakdown, and I've already talked a lot, so it'll have to be one of you. Who can explain Monopoly for us?
I'm behind schedule, on doing this, so I don't think we actually need anybody to explain how Monopoly works.
Are you sure?
I don't think
it is.
I'm not sure because you never know.
We should do a one-minute breakdown and see if they line up with the explanations.
Yeah, see if we all get. We should all list our favorite Monopoly stories that we've had at the end of this game, or at the end of this podcast, and see if we have some good. Because I think this is actually a game that generates better stories than sessions sometimes. I think we all have those moments.
I think some will come out, but I have volunteered to do the breakdown because I haven't done that many, if any, I don't know, this season, I don't think yet.
I don't recall.
With the incredibly hard task that I've taken on to try and break Monopoly down in 1 minute.
Okay, are you ready?
So each player rolls two dice on their turn and travels that many spaces around a clockwise path. If they land on a property that is purchasable, then they can buy that property. And then when future players land on that property, they can charge the owning player can charge them rent. The owning player can also add houses and hotels later in the game that makes the rent even higher. The idea is that you go round and round the game board, occasionally hitting on other spaces that they have to draw a card or go to jail, and the cards have various random effects. And it's the last man standing wins after everyone else has been bankrupted.
Excellent.
I could add in some of the other rules like stations and stuff if we've got the time to do it, but let's not.
Nah. Well, let's talk about the history of Monopoly a little bit. Ian is going to give us a more detailed breakdown because Monopoly actually has a rather complicated history. But the first form of Monopoly was a game called Landlord's Game, and that was released in 1924, a whole century ago, as of the recording of this podcast, by designer Elizabeth Maggie. She had the game patented in 1904, so 20 years before that. The version most of us are familiar with by Parker Brothers was, I want to say, quote-unquote, designed by Charles Darrow, and that was released in 1935. So this is probably the oldest game we'll ever talk about on this cast. The original artist was Elizabeth Maggie for the Landlord's Game. There was no artist listed in the Parker Brothers version. Obviously, it was self-published by Maggie originally, then by Parker Brothers, and published many, many times over in many, many versions. There's never really been an award that has been won by Monopoly, but according to World of Monopoly, there are over 3,471 editions of the game. That includes any given version being released in different languages. And in fact, one of the things we're going to run into in this cast is that I played a version of Monopoly with completely different properties than my other two co-hosts. And so that's something, when I'm talking about Boardwalk and Park Place, I don't know what the two most expensive properties are in the UK version, but it's not that.
Mayfair and
Park Lane. There you go. Anyway, every...
Talking about the versions, my kids have got a version of Monopoly, which is make your own. So there's wow. almost an infinite version of Monopoly. So you can fill in your own street names and stuff in it. There's almost infinite numbers of versions. So that's, you know, almost like legacy Monopoly, if you will.
Yeah. Back in the late 90s, I had a version of Monopoly that was Star Wars themed, and it had these nice pewter pieces. It were really probably a lot fancier than the game deserved. But this was before the prequels had ever even come out. So it had, I think, Coruscant and the Death Star were the last two properties. Because the fact is, every franchise eventually gets a Monopoly game. My own son has a Lord of the Rings movie Monopoly game. Every big band, every film you've known has made it into a version of Monopoly. And in fact, in the U.S., this, I don't know if this happens in the U.K., but in the U.S., it's very common for big state universities to have a themed version of Monopoly based on the campus. And it'll have all the properties will be wow. based on various on the stadium and different halls and res halls and everything like that. And they're all sold in like the campus store of every major university. So it's okay. a really common wow. thing. As of 2015, 275 million copies have been sold.
And I couldn't find a more updated number than that, unfortunately, when I was looking around.
Now, 275 isn't very 275 million is not that impressive. I'm sure it's more impressive now. Gentlemen, I want to hear, how did we first come across this game?
I honestly don't know, but probably like I've had a games cupboard at home, basically. Like, sort of like my parents had a friend in Ravensburger, so we had some of the like, early Ravensburger titles that came over. Which is really cool. Some like really sort of well-regarded titles in there. Good fun. But yeah, I'm sure there's a copy of Monopoly in there, and it definitely came out from time to time to play Monopoly. Yeah, I honestly don't remember how many times I played, but almost definitely multiple times. It's sort of introduction to board games, that cupboard of board games that my parents has. Yeah, just came out of the cupboard, played it because it was what my parents had.
So I have a bit more of a story for this because my mum is actually quite a fan of Monopoly and she remains quite a fan of Monopoly. She claims if you talk to her about it, and I have broken it down for her in probably painful detail for her, and she will still claim it is a strategic game because it involves negotiation. That's her hill, and she's gonna stick on it. So I mean, we didn't play it loads because we all had other things to do, and as we all know, it's a fairly long game. But we did play it quite a lot. Because she is a fan of Monopoly, we played it properly, largely by the rules. We're going to come to this later. Of course, most people grow up playing one or more variants. Very few.
I don't think I've ever played it by the right rules. I'm honestly not sure.
I was going to say, we largely have. And the one twist, the one thing we did do that was differently is that after everyone had been around the board two or three times, there would be a pause and we would auction off all the remaining properties, which I actually think is a decent little variant, which does improve the game and may help explain why I have slightly fonder memories of it than a lot of people growing up. I don't know. There was one time I recall, I learned an important lesson from Monopoly because it was left out one night. We couldn't finish a game. And while my parents were busy off doing parenting things, I secretly added a bunch of £500 notes to my stash and came back the next day and took a storming victory. A storming and memorable victory, which felt completely hollow and pointless because it was neither like luck or skill that had earned me the win. So I learned early that cheaters don't prosper. So you're only cheating yourself, essentially.
It wasn't luck or skill, but it was capitalism, I think.
I was going to say, it's like
it was very on brand for this game. Yeah.
considering its history, which we're about to get to as well. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I honestly can't remember a time when I didn't know about Monopoly. I think my earliest memory of the game, I was 3 or 4 years old. I was young. And I think we had some teenagers at our house for like a church function or something like that. And I watched them play it. I was just like, just observing kind of thing. And I don't even think I'd played a full game all the way through until I was probably in high school. And I actually did play a fair bit in high school and then some into college. And then I kind of drifted away from it. And I don't think I've played a game in its entirety since then. But I've played a whole lot of partial games, which is actually maybe even more universal than playing with house rules, is playing only part of a game of Monopoly. Well, we want to talk about influences on the game, and I'm actually going to turn this over to Ian because Ian is going to give us a more detailed history lesson here on this because it's really fascinating. Ian, take it away.
Okay, yeah, so what regular listeners will know we usually do here is like talk about actual influences in the game and what we think like games or designers or whatever were influencing that particular moment in time, how that game came to be. In this case, obviously, we're talking very, very early board games, and what we wanted to do instead was maybe cover a little bit of history of Elizabeth Maggie and how Monopoly came to be. So Elizabeth Maggie, she was born in 1866 in Canton, Illinois, father James, mother Mary. James toured around with Abraham Lincoln. He was a popular speaker, clerked for the Illinois legislature, and ran for office on an anti-monopoly platform, but lost. He didn't believe in ownership of land at all. He introduced his daughter Elizabeth to a book by a guy called Henry George called Poverty and Progress. And that book basically had similar ideas that it didn't believe in the ownership of land, and it believed that people that did own land should be taxed for that. It was a very popular book, outsold all books but the Bible in the 1890s. Now, she went on to be a stenographer at the Dead Letters Office. If you don't know what dead letters are, that's basically where letters would go that no one knows where they went to. Someone's written on George in Illinois, and that's all they've got. That kind of thing. That's what dead letters are. In her spare time, she turned her hand to comedy and engineering. She saved up enough money to get her own place and had a male roommate who was an actor. Both these things are extremely unusual at the time, a woman owning her own property and having a male roommate. She filed a patent for a device that allowed paper to go through typewriters more easily. She was a pretty smart lady. She taught classes about Georgism at night, which was the book she'd read, Henry George, Poverty and Progress. It became a sort of movement. She started designing a board game to pass on the lessons of Georgism and applied for that patent called The Landlord's Game in 1903, and that was granted in 1904. Now, board games were becoming popular around this time, and it was a few years after the patent was applied for when Elizabeth was in her 40s that she published the game for the first time. It was published through the Economic Game Company that she was part owner of. The original game, The Landlord's Game, had two modes. The Monopolist mode that we would recognize as the modern version of the game we call Monopoly, and also an anti-monopolist prosperity version that rewarded players who generated wealth. This was the version designed to teach Georgism. The idea was to show that the latter version of the game was superior to the former and that the ideas could benefit society. The prosperity version ended when the player with the least amount of money at the start of the game doubled their money, so it was effectively cooperative. Might be the earliest cooperative game? Don't know. The game didn't make much of a splash at the time. In 1909, she made a game called Mock Trial that isn't on Board Game Geek, sent it to Parker Brothers, who published it. And in 1913, The Landlord's Game was published in Scotland under the name Brer Fox and Rabbit. And that game is on Board Game Geek as a sort of spin-off of Monopoly, as our sort of progenitor to it. Now, Elizabeth filed an update to the patent for The Landlord Game in 1923. She lived in Chicago at this point and added locations that reflected that to the board. The game had become a hit amongst left-wing thinkers on college campuses, and folk would make copies of the game to give to family members, tweaking things as they went as well, rules and all sorts. It started to become known as Monopoly around about the year 1927. Around this time also the Great Depression hits, and a college dropout who had to go home starts to make copies of the game. One calls their version Finance to avoid copyright issues. Someone took their version of Monopoly to Atlantic City Friends School, a Quakers school in Atlantic City, and that version had Midwestern names in it. Colors are added, properties are grouped into three, chance and community cards are added around about that time. Prices in the city were mimicked in the game, and people were hooked. And no one wrote down the rules, they all knew how to play, and the Quakers introduced it to their friends, including one called Charles Darrow. Now, Darrow is unemployed at this point because the Great Depression is going on. Quite loads and loads of people are unemployed. He asks for the rules for the games from the folk who introduced it to them and then ghosts them. An Irish friend of Darrow's illustrates the game and calls it Monopoly. There is no reference to the version of the game, Georgism, or any of the symbols that are referenced in that version. And the game is now pro-capitalism. Parker Brothers is in financial trouble at this point in time. After the wife of one of the heads of the company plays Monopoly and likes it, the game is bought from Darrow for $7,000 plus residuals. That's about $120,000 today, best I could work out. Monopoly sweeps the country, loads of profits, Parker Brothers is saved. People are staying in because of the Depression and they turn to board games. Darrow becomes immensely rich and doesn't mention anything to do with the previous versions of the game. Now, Parker Brothers had been sued previously over Tiddlywinks and Ping Pong. They tried to basically patent them, saying that they were Parker Brothers' inventions. They would go around and buy up the rights of anyone who said they made it, but they lost both cases because the games were considered folk games, effectively. Everyone knew how to play these games, everyone had components. Darrow writes a fake history of the creation of the game, and Parker Brothers realized that the game had previously been called Finance because they'd done some of their own digging. They buy out the rights to that game. They apply for a patent in August of 1935, and it is quickly granted. Now, in November 1935, they approach one Elizabeth Maggie about the Landlord's game because they found out about it. Parker Brothers approached her about putting out that version of the game, the original game, and a couple of other games she has worked on. She's absolutely delighted, agrees to a deal for about $500 and no residuals. They made the game as they promised. It goes on sale with no publicity at all, just to say they have, and they now have the rights to the Landlord's game. There's a bit of controversy at the time with this. Many of the Quakers who had played it previously to the Darrow release said it wasn't his, but didn't sue as they thought no one owed it. They thought it was basically a folk game. Darrow is famous. He appears in newspapers, on TV shows. He dies on August 28th, 1967. He's the first millionaire game designer in history off a game he didn't design. In 1973, a San Francisco State University professor, Ralph Ansbach, publishes an anti-Monopoly game. Parker Brothers sue him in 1974, trying to shut it down. Realizing if he can prove the game existed before the 1935 patent they own, he goes digging. He finds Elizabeth Maggie's patents and the college dropout guy who made Finance, who still has a board and is still alive. That guy agrees to testify in court that everyone called the game Monopoly back when he made Finance. Ralph uncovers more people who had played it before the patent. After 2 years, Parker Brothers offered to settle with Ralph. They offered him an executive position at Parker Brothers and $5,000. Ralph says no. His lawyer quits. The case goes on for years and Parker Brothers win. In 1977, Parker Brothers make a show of winning the case and bury about 40,000 copies of Ralph's anti-Monopoly game in a landfill. Ralph appeals. He loses again. He's got one more chance to do this, so he appeals again in summer of 1982. The US Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit rules against Parker Brothers. The original court case is reversed, and the trademark Monopoly is ruled invalid. From the court case notes, there's this quote: "The court's reference to Charles Darrow as the inventor or creator of the game is clearly erroneous." Parker Brothers appeals to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court passes and doesn't want anything to do with it. Ralph wins. And the true history of Monopoly had been revealed in court. Finally. Elizabeth unfortunately died in 1948, so didn't get to see any of this. So yeah, it's a bizarre story full of capitalism from an anti-capitalist game. I got most of that information from a podcast I listened to called The Dollop, which is a sort of American history slash comedy podcast. They got a lot of that information from a book called The Monopolist, which is sort of a history of Monopoly and Elizabeth Maggie and the Parker Brothers and all that nonsense that went on. Yeah.
Excellent.
It's a bizarre story.
It is really bizarre, and it's really interesting how long the corporate story was of Darrow. And in fact, the first copy my family had, this is probably bought in, I want to say, the early 80s. The copy that we had a little Q&A thing, basically what an early FAQ about Monopoly, and it said who had designed it? Clarence Darrow, 1935.
Yeah.
And it almost sounded, now Ian, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you were telling the story, it sounded like Darrow didn't, at least initially, did not knowingly rip off this game from Elizabeth Maggie. That he kind of ripped off a game that had been kind of in the ether in his area. And then, is that sort of how it went?
Yeah, I think so. He knowingly ripped off different people instead.
Right. Basically. Well, I mean, that happens all the time.
Maggie's name wasn't on it. It was effectively a folk game at the time. People were making their own copies to give to friends. And where he learned it was sort of there's a Quaker community that's playing it a lot, and he learned it from one of the families there. Asked for the rules and then disappeared with all the information in order to make his own copies and actually sell the game.
Okay. Well, I mean, Matt, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, not particularly. I mean, it's I think we all know bits of this, or at least most board gamers have come across the idea that Monopoly was not designed or originally owned by Parker Brothers, that it belonged to a female designer and was an anti-capitalist educational game almost. But it's... It's really fascinating. I especially didn't actually realize myself any of that latter stuff after the court cases that went on, you know, into the 70s, you said. You know, that's quite extraordinary. The convoluted ins and outs of that story really are quite something. And it all adds to the mystique of the game.
In fact, the invalidation of the trademark is why so many American universities have a campus version. They don't have to pay They don't have to pay rights to Parker Brothers to do it. They just make a new version with little, you know, campus-themed pieces and little paper money and print their own board. And that's it's effectively public domain for all intent and purposes in the U.S. and in the U.K. as well. Do they have the non-branded versions in the U.K. as well?
I think all the versions I see in the U.K. are branded Monopoly. But they're like sort of official versions, but lots of towns and cities have them.
Okay.
Like some football clubs as well.
That might be the same thing where it's all just because of this invalid trademark. It's pretty amazing. All right. Well, let's talk about the impact at the time, because you even touched on this some, Ian, while you were in your discussion there. How did this game affect people? It wasn't even really a board game hobby at the time. How did it? What impact did it have at the time?
From what I know from the source I read, it was pretty popular. I mean, it sold enough to save Parker Brothers. So you know, it sold a good number of copies, and yeah, I think people were quite into board gaming at the time. But I think Matt's got a bit more information on that than I do.
Yeah, I don't know if they were like massively into board games, but the point is that it was a growing thing. I mean, the origins of commercial board gaming came up during the Victorian era, when they were seen as like moral educational type games to sort of like give to your children to while away the hours, and so they wouldn't pester their parents while they were taking opium. But there was a down dip in the 20s and the 10s because of obviously there was the Great War and then the Spanish flu and then the Great Depression, but at the same time that also meant there were more people spending time at home, and there were people spending time, you know, Mahjong became popular in the 20s, I think, and Contract Bridge because it was invented. I mean, Bridge is a much older game, but Contract Bridge, the modern version we know now, was invented about 1925. So there was certainly definitely a game market for this when it came out. But one curious thing about the early days of Monopoly that I learned myself recently, because I wrote an article for Senate magazine, an excellent and most esteemed publication if you aren't already subscribed to it, about Christmas board games. And while researching that, I discovered that Monopoly is actually... there's an early association between Monopoly and Christmas, and by extension, board games and Christmas, because one of the reasons Parker Brothers picked this up off Darrow is because he was able to demonstrate that his game was selling like hotcakes over Christmas. You know, that early association between spending festive time board gaming and particularly spending festive time playing Monopoly with your family is very, very old. You know, it goes right back to before this was even picked up by a licensed publisher.
Fascinating.
That's really interesting. I think that even still holds a little bit today, because it's still continued to be a pretty big seller. You know, we're closing in on a century of the branded version here, and that's still, it still has a lot of that staying power, which is pretty amazing. Let's talk about the critical impressions we have of this game. And Matt, I'm going to go ahead and start with you, and then Ian, we'll kind of go over to you. And because I think you know, because the thing about Monopoly, every board gamer comes into it with a preconceived notion. We all had an opinion on Monopoly before we were in this hobby, I think. And that maybe is unique of all the games we've talked about so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. I mean, I, as I've said earlier, don't have this kind of negative, overwhelmingly negative perception of Monopoly that other people seem to have, because other people seem to have, because my childhood memories of playing it are at best mediocre, and at best positive. I enjoyed the game. I had time spent with my family, and as a result of that, my feeling has always been very much that there's a half decent game inside Monopoly, which is kind of struggling to get out somewhere. The problem that I have it with is the length. If you could somehow make it shorter and increase the negotiation auction elements of it, I mean, it wouldn't suddenly be a magically great game, but it would be worthwhile. And I actually still play it occasionally with friends. It sounds like I've played it more recently than you two, certainly. I mean, once every few years, probably, it comes out. I have a friend who's got a really nice board. It's like wooden, 3D board. The board doubles as a box. There are drawers in the bottom that you open up to put the pieces.
I've seen that version. It's really nice.
Exactly. So it's fun to play on, you know, it's good. And my experience is that it's great fun, well, not great fun, but it's fun for an hour. It's good fun. You know, you're excited to see where you're going to end up on the board, what properties you're going to be able to get, whether you're going to be able to whip in with a quick auction when somebody else can't buy anything and complete a set, that kind of stuff. And then after that, when you're beyond that point, you're just going round and round and round, wondering whether to add houses and who's going to go bankrupt first. It just becomes increasingly tiresome, although the friends I play it with seem to dig it still. And one thing I found really interesting about this, I mean, I won't belabor the strategies of Monopoly, because we all know that there are strategies. You know, you buy certain ones, you rely on certain areas of the board that are going to, with the bell curve of a 2d6, going to see more footfall than others. And if you can get, a Monopoly on one of those areas, then you're gold and you're almost certainly going to win, thanks to the laws of statistics. But the interesting thing about making the game shorter is that a few years ago, Hasbro, I think, did put out a game that did just that, a version that did just that. I don't remember the name of it. There were so many versions of Monopoly, and they all have such similar names that it becomes really difficult to go back and look this up. But I think it was one that was called the Ultimate Banking Edition. And it had an electronic bank. It was one of the first ones that had like electronic gizmo to had a bank. And it did various other things, tweaks to the rules and the property ownership and the money flow in the game to make it faster. And they said it played in about an hour and a half. I've never played it. I don't know. As far as I know, sank that trace. I've never seen a copy in a shop. I've never seen one on a table in play anywhere. And what's interesting about that to me is that I think almost everybody, even people who have nothing to do with the board game hobby, might play a game like that, and they might all sit down and they might agree, well, actually, yeah, this is better. This is better than ordinary Monopoly because it doesn't take 3 hours, and it doesn't necessarily lead to people throwing blancmange at Uncle Tom when he buys Park Lane or something, you know?
I think this just became autobiographical.
I think so, yeah.
The question is, why then did it not take off? Well, of course, maybe it wasn't marketed as much, but we've already talked about this idea that Monopoly is or was a folk game. And it almost seems to me that one possible explanation is that it's a folk activity, in the sense that you do the thing this way because it's always been done this way. It's like, I know loads of people, because we all know, again, that the probably the most popular house rule is the money on free parking. All money goes on free parking, and then you land on free parking, you get the money. Almost everybody I know knows that rule, and almost everybody I know has been told by me not to play with that rule, and they accept the rationale for doing so. They accept the rationale, but they still want to do it, because that's the way it's always been done. And I just find that kind of bizarre, that people will not buy into the structural mechanics of Monopoly, even on the most basic, simple level. You know, you put more money into the game, it goes on for longer, and that's not a great thing because you're just going round and round in circles. And, you know, this is not a difficult concept, but even clever people I know who understand that still will argue with me about the free parking thing, because it's just what they're used to. It's what they've been brought up with. And so many house rules in Monopoly and bits and versions of Monopoly are like that. It's just an activity that is done a certain way because it's the way that thing's done, like a ritual almost, like some weird kind of, like, you know, wicker man with pewter top hats.
That would give that film a very different tone.
Yeah, it would.
So did you say there, Matt, that the game didn't really take off?
I don't know, that version of the game, this ultimate banking
version. Oh, sorry,
version,
right, okay.
I didn't make that clear.
The version,
I've not seen anywhere. There was a brief advertising campaign, which is how I became aware of it, and I thought, actually, that sounds engaging to me. I might grab a copy to play with the kids. Because my kids, it was a time when my kids were interested in the folk game and the Monopoly, and in the end, as I said, I bought them this version that they could make themselves, which they did.
It was called the Ultimate Banking version. I was looking that up while you were talking. That's what it was called. Ultimate Banking Monopoly. And it did have a little like electronic thing. Yeah, I mean, I agree that Monopoly is it's interesting to call it a folk activity. In our show notes, I basically have written down Monopoly is a folk game. Discuss. Because it kind of is. I made a horrendous mistake at the talk that Matt and I were at in Dragon Meet, where we were talking about older games. And I asked a room full of gamers how many of them had read the rules of Monopoly, expecting it to be quite low. But it was about 50-50, I think. Like, people had read rules.
It was a decent number.
Yeah, it was a decent number. But there's still a lot of people in a room full of people at a gaming convention that had not read the rules to Monopoly, but I probably still played it. And it's just one of those things. Like, I am pretty certain that I have never played Monopoly properly. Not 100%, because I can't remember all the times I've played Monopoly, but pretty certain. And it is one of those games that gets passed down kind of with like family house rules and that kind of thing, or it certainly was. I mean, in the modern era you might find other things are getting passed down now, I don't know, but for a long time Monopoly, Cluedo, those kind of things were in people's games cupboards, right, at home or wherever. They were the games that came out at Christmas, like Pit, that, you know, those kind of things. That's what came out at Christmas and was played, and you were taught it by your parents and maybe read the rules to those things, but a lot of people, I guess, didn't, and just learned it from their parents and then learned to play it that way. So, I mean, like Matt, I don't really come in with like a hatred of Monopoly or anything like that. I mean, it is what it is. It's a sort of family game. It's undeniably successful. I mean, it sold 275 million copies in 20 last we know, and it's going to have sold even more by now. There's constant new versions of it all the time. Like, I can't like critically recommend it. I mean, I haven't played it recently, so I don't remember. But I'm not going to say rush out and buy Monopoly. But it's an interesting thing that it's like, yeah, it's a folk activity. It's one of those things you sit down and like do with friends and parents and like bond, even if it's antagonistically. I remember one year the Brainwaves cast reported on a helpline for Monopoly. It was meant to resolve like arguments at the
family strife
around Christmas. Yeah. So you can like and like resolve family strife around the Monopoly board. I mean, we haven't really talked about the sort of roll and move element. I mean, roll and move games are maligned quite a lot by the sort of hobby gamers. And we talked about that in Talisman as well. Like, are all roll and move games just rubbish, or is it a mechanism that is unfairly maligned, I ask you?
I think it is. I think that it is not. It's not a mechanism which is inherently rubbish. I know certainly it. I've only thought of this right now, but there was a game that did the rounds a few years ago called Magical Athlete. You ever heard of Magical Athlete?
Oh, yeah.
I love that game, Matt.
I've heard good things about Magical Athlete.
That game's a hoot.
But it was a roll and move game that people have certainly enjoyed. And before you talked about Magical Athlete, Nate, I didn't know you played it, because I'd love to hear about Magical Athlete. But I want to just quickly chip in there and say it's kind of interesting to myself looking back at it that I've realised I've just given you my critical impressions of Monopoly without giving you any critical impressions of Monopoly, because there is this just presumption that it's bad. You know, I have just gone in there and presumed that it's the reaction to it is going to be negative. And I'm saying, well, my reactions may be a little bit better than negative, but I haven't really broken down why that is at all. And I'm not going to, because we don't need to, I don't think. You've just done some of it there, Ian, helpfully. And a lot of our listeners will know the rest of this stuff off by heart. But it's just kind of really interesting how that assumption is so very deep-seated that I didn't even feel the need to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually interesting you're talking about that, because we all, Monopoly is the shibboleth in board gaming hobby, the specific wing of Board Game Geek, right? I mean, like, oh, it's not like Monopoly, as if it would be this huge shame for a game to be like Monopoly. And it's, you know, it serves a similar role in board gaming that Dungeons and Dragons does in the role-playing world, which is where when you talk about it's kind of a, I mean, it's the biggest, most successful one. I don't need to defend it. It doesn't care about my opinions of it, right? I mean, it's a corporate entity, but it takes a lot of flack for just being popular and for being very available and for being people's main frame of reference. And I understand why that is, because it's far from a perfect game, Matt. You talked about a lot of the issues it has that there are with the game. I think my biggest issue is just I like roll and move as a rule, but so much of this game moving depends on the right roll coming up. You know, you need to land on someone's property for it to actually pay off. And yeah, there's a lot of problems with it, but the discussions around Monopoly can get very snotty and very elitist quite quickly, as if these unwashed masses would, if they only had the enlightenment that we had, if they had heard the gospel of Pandemic or of Seven Wonders or of whatever game you happen to like, they would turn their backs on Monopoly and they would see the good news of hobby board gaming, and we'd all be joining hands and we'd have Ravensburger factories all over the world and just whatever, you know. There'd be some, but it's just a sort of like everyone is these benighted people who we only have been brainwashed by corporate propaganda to think Monopoly is good. And in fact, I think Monopoly is, on the whole, pretty solid for a game that's 90 years old. You know, Matt, I'll go a step further than you and say that I think the game actually is just one or two judicious house rules away from being a pretty fun game for the most part. Like, I just, some that I came across on Board Game Geek when I was going through my Geek Buddy thing, because I'd like doing this. This is what I use Board Game Geek for mostly. But one person suggested play and, you know, limit it to like four people. I think that's good advice. Don't play this game with like six or eight. That's going to take you all week to do.
Oh,
there's 10 tokens. There's 10 tokens in the game.
Oh God, there is as well, aren't there? Oh
yeah. No. So, I mean, so you see that and you're like, yeah, sure. 8-10 people, go for it. Four is just about right. But the big one I heard was when the second person goes bankrupt, take a look at everyone's value. Whoever has the most value of their property, call it, they win the game. You're probably playing an hour and a half, 2 hour game at that point. Maybe you can, bump it down to the first person to go bankrupt. Matt, I love that variant that your family had, where once you've gone a couple times around the board, auction off the rest of the stuff. It's not hard to do. And in fact, I think the reason Monopoly survives as a folk game is because the basic structure of it is pretty straightforward. And it's easy to, we've talked about games that are just easy to hack. And Monopoly is very easy to hack because there's just so little there. And in fact, so much of the game, even as played by the rules, exists in negative space in the rules. And by that, I mean, there's, it says in the rules, okay, auction off unsold properties. The rules don't really say how to do that. And now that we've all been in this hobby long enough, we talked about modern art earlier, you know, we know how many cool ways to auction off games, and that would make the game really interesting and might create different things. But the rules don't say how. It just says auction it off. It doesn't give any parameters for deal making, but deal making is a vital part of Monopoly. That's such a fundamental part of the game. The negotiation aspect that your mom loves so much, Matt, that's such a part of the game, but it's not like there's no structure to that. There's not like an alliance phase like there is in Cosmic Encounter or something. And I think that that's really why kind of the game has survived, is it kind of, because it has so much negative space where interesting stuff is happening. I wrote in the show notes I'm going to back away from how strongly worded I did put this in the show notes because I don't want to make Matt blow a gasket, but it reminds me a lot of Risk in this way. It reminds me a lot of Risk because Risk is also a game where a lot happens in the negative space. The alliances, the backstabbing, that stuff that's not really laid out in the rules. It's just a thing that happens naturally, organically in the course of the game.
Yeah, Nate, that's not what you put in the show notes. What you put in the show notes.
No, it's not. I'm softening it. I said I was softening it. Well, here's what I say. I do like Monopoly more than Risk, which I think says more about, I don't love conquest games. That's never been a, like, I don't like, I, someone screws me in Monopoly, I'm like, ah, whatever, it's Monopoly, it's cool. You know, I'm fine, no worries. But something about getting screwed in Risk just makes that like puts me in the bad place. So I think that's why I feel that way. But I think the two games, they have a lot of kind of a similar impact. And I think, you know, we talk like, you know, Risk has had a very direct influence on the hobby. There's so many games in the hobby that are like Risk clones, right? But when you look at Monopoly, I think its biggest contribution is, I don't know. And I mean, you know, it's hard to know, right, over 100 years ago, but I can't think of another game that had quite the same embodied experience that Monopoly had, where it put you in the role of someone and said, you know, you don't need to hear the rules, because you look at this board, you're like, okay, these are properties, you have money, you make money on the properties, you try to bankrupt the other people. That's elemental. That's like something that people see and understand immediately.
True.
Yeah, you can look at the moralistic side of it, but I think that I don't want to say it was the first designer, you know, that's a very designer board game kind of thing, to put you in the shoes of someone thematically. And I'm sure other games did it beforehand that I just don't have access to, but Monopoly is probably the earliest one that we know about. I don't know. What do you guys think of that?
I think the problem with part of what you're saying, so the bit about being in someone's shoes, yeah, you know, I completely buy that, actually. That's a very interesting observation. But in terms of this kind of like elemental aspect to go around the board buying properties that you talk about, I think it's actually really hard to tell whether that's true. I'm not saying it's wrong. But
oh, that's true.
No, it is such a cultural artifact that how do you know it's elemental from the board layout, or is it just something you've absorbed by cultural osmosis, to be honest? So I don't think you can really make that claim. You just can't be sure. I have to chip in and say that the argument I thought we were going to have is that I really like Risk. I actually think it's quite a good game. You know, I'll go that far. Like, just like you are with Monopoly, you know, I'll defend Risk. I've had loads of great time playing Risk, and that is perhaps worthy of an episode next season in its own right. I don't know. But I'm definitely a Risk fan, and I don't take kindly to your Monopoly comparisons. But structurally, you are right. I take your point. Absolutely. Structurally speaking, yes, there is this, a lot happens in a space that is not defined by the rules, more so in Risk than it does in Monopoly, and that's absolutely correct.
Well, so let's talk about something that we could probably spend a whole cast talking about this next part, but let's talk about how Monopoly has influenced our current era, either in the hobby or outside of the hobby.
I was going to come back to this, the point that you made, Nate, about like people being sort of snooty about Monopoly and like, you know, if only they'd heard of Pandemic or Catan or whatever, they would come to us. But everyone's got to get their board game start somewhere, right? And quite often that's Monopoly, because I wouldn't say every household in the world has got a copy of Monopoly, but a lot of people do. Some probably multiple copies of Monopoly. But, you know, it's a very accessible game. It's like, it'll be in libraries, it'll be in Waterstones, it'll be, you know, it's in your local supermarket all the time. You can get access to it and you can pick up and play, and it's relatively simple. You roll some dice, you move around, you like buy properties, you try and bankrupt people. Everyone kind of knows how it goes, like you were saying, Nate. So yeah, there's got to be an intro somewhere, and I'd rather there be an intro than none. Yeah, and
right,
people, not a lot of people are going to want to necessarily pick up a game about diseases, especially in the last few years, yeah, for instance.
Too real.
Or, I mean, like, Catan is good, but it's definitely more complicated. Like, there's more going on there. There's more to learn. A roll and move is a very, very simple thing. I mean, I put in the show notes a question of, is there a modern board game designer who hasn't played this game? And the answer to that is probably yes, considering we've got a lot more board game designers now, a lot more diverse board game designers now, and we're further removed from Monopoly being... Or board games only being like Monopoly and Cluedo and Uno and things like that. But it's got to be like a lot of board game designers who are currently about like first exposure to the hobby or exposure to board games, right? Just law of averages.
Quite possibly. But, you know, it's a better introduction to board games in some ways than, say, Candyland. because there's actually something going on. It's not just rolling a dice and going around a track. And it's also, I feel, worth mentioning that my lived experience rather sort of like undermines the attitude that you talked about there, where there is this, you know, this immediate dismissal of you know, if only you had seen the light, you would come over to the light side kind of thing. Because I play hobby games with all my friends, and every few years somebody goes, "Oh, can't we just play Monopoly tonight?" And everyone goes, "Yeah." and we all have a good time because I'm playing a game with my friends. You know, it's they have seen the light, and they have not been tempted. They have stayed on the dark side and have fun playing with their pewter cars.
I mean, I think that really snobby attitude does come from like a sort of elitist segment of the board game community, which is probably quite vocal, but not very large.
No, but this is partly why I wanted to bring it out and kind of like criticize it, so you dispel it, because it's very unpleasant. It's really not very nice.
No, it's not. It's not at all. And like, I mean, we started the season by talking about Catan, which by anyone's sort of critical reckoning is kind of the dawn of the modern hobby board game sort of era. I mean, lots of us, including me, got our start into like going, "Hey, board games are a thing I might want to play more of," with something like Monopoly.
Yeah, there's so many parts of Monopoly that it's probably your first exposure to so many different types of mechanics. The big one being trading and deal making. Like, you're not going to play in it. It's the first game, certainly the first game I played that involved that. Before I played Monopoly, I had never done an auction in a board game. I didn't know an auction was a thing you could do in a board game, which is insane to say, having talked about modern art this year and how many auction games there are. But I think that maybe Monopoly is not... I'm not sure we have a lot of games that I can point to and say, "Oh, that is a Monopoly clone." Because what's the point of cloning Monopoly? There's just always Monopoly there.
Yeah.
But I think where it really has had an impact on really on broader culture. And I think a lot of that is on the kind of mimetic side of Monopoly. The do not pass go, do not collect $200.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that in the UK and in the US, it's different what the properties are, but those properties are kind of synonymous with, you know, Boardwalk and Park Place, that's the nice place in the US. And the lousy slums are Mediterranean Avenue and Baltic Avenue. I don't know. What are the cheap properties in the UK? Do you know?
It's Mayfair and Park Lane are the really expensive ones. And the cheap ones are Old Kent Road. Hold on. I'm going to look this up because I don't actually remember. List of London Monopoly locations. Thanks, Wikipedia. Old Kent Road and Whitechapel Road are the cheap ones in...
And see, all I know about Whitechapel Road is that's where Jack the Ripper's murders happen. So, right? I don't think we have any listeners on the hosting this cast right now. I think that's really where we have seen the... And there's little small things like that, like winning second place in a beauty contest. bank error in your favor and stuff like that. I think there's a lot of stuff that's entered into the lexicon through Monopoly. And then the other impact, I know this is really shallow, but it's something I think of whenever I play a game that involves paper money. I just kind of am reminded of Monopoly. Whenever I played Acquire, whenever I play Power Grid, those are games I play with some frequency. I just want to use paper money. I don't know. It feels nostalgic. It feels fun. And I don't need I don't need poker chips personally. No, give me the paper money. It's fun.
We will cover it eventually, but Lords of Vegas is one of my favorite games, and it has paper money, and I love it for that. And I don't know if you've ever played Millennium Blades, Nate.
Oh, once.
Millennium Blades is a very, very strange game, folks, about being card game players playing a card game, and you like collect cards in between playing.
It's like you're a professional CCG player.
Yeah, but the money tokens in it, like the individual single tokens in it, are wads of paper cash, so you can slap them down.
That's right.
You were talking about the mimetic thing of it. One of the things we get from like this, and it's the thing that the sort of snobby people hate, is like, you know, I play board games, or what, like Monopoly? I'd rather that they knew a board game name.
Yeah.
Than no board game name, and didn't look at me like, "What, board games with wood? What are you talking about? What's a board game? Do you mean you do woodworking?" Like, I'd much rather there was some knowledge of what board games are in wider culture than nothing at all.
Matt, did you have anything you wanted to add about the influence of Monopoly that we haven't already covered?
I like the idea that you came up with, you know, this idea that Monopoly is the first game that gives you an individual perspective. But on a wider scale, I'm not sure that I buy the idea that it's a particularly influential game, weirdly, despite its huge ubiquity, because there are so many things that it borrowed from other things. So Roll and Move was the de facto way of playing a board game prior to Monopoly, basically. I don't know when things started to change, but through the 1800s, as we were talking about, that was how almost all board games were played. You roll and you move. Bidding and auctions goes back to card games. Things like, I spoke about Contract Bridge. There you go. Bidding, not auctions, but there were card games, playing card games with auctions in them that predated Monopoly. And you could argue that in terms of putting it in, you know, putting somebody in the shoes of a character and having them fulfill a role. I mean, they're more niche titles, but you could say Kriegsspiel. I mean, you know, it's not exactly novel when it comes to Monopoly. It was the first mass market game probably that did that. And you could also argue that a game like Snakes and Ladders, which is borrowed from Hindu mythology, puts you in a role. You are the role of a child learning moral lessons as you go around the board and go. Mm-hmm. This is semantics to some extent, but I think actually two things. First of all, designer we should really be crediting with what influences Monopoly has had is, of course, not Charles Darrow, but you know, it should be Elizabeth
Maggie.
I thought it was, because she's got two first names. I didn't know if it was Elizabeth Maggie or Maggie's Elizabeth. I was getting confused there for a moment. And secondly, that a lot of the design lessons, a lot of the design influences had are negative ones. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do the other. You'll end up with a game like Monopoly. You know, it is some ways a poster child of how you know, it's interesting. We all talked, Nate and I both obviously share the opinion that there's a reasonable game in there somewhere. I don't know if you feel like that as well, Ian, but either way, it's almost like a poster child for the business of board game development. You know, where you get sent a half-finished thing by a designer, and you put it through some rounds of play testing, and you get some feedback, and you talk to other professionals, and you come up with something better at the end. And it's like Monopoly almost hasn't had that segment of the process, maybe partly because it was a folk game, and now we're back in that, not having that process thanks to Kickstarter. But that's a whole different discussion.
Ooh. Kickstarter is going to create the new Monopoly. That's what Matt Thrower just said.
I'm going to put that quote at the top of the cast notes.
In more ways than
Kickstarter
one.
Kickstarter will give us the next Monopoly.
In more ways than one, it is the next Monopoly Kickstarter. Yeah,
yeah. No, but you're absolutely right, Matt. That, like, the person we need to be, like, reminding people of that actually, if there's any influence on the current era, it's down to Elizabeth Maggie and the Landlord's Game, because it was her game.
And not Maggie.
In the first place. And without it, Monopoly would not have existed.
Speaking of getting names wrong, I now realize I think I called Charles Darrow Clarence Darrow, who was, of course, one of the lawyers in the Scopes Monkey trial. So I got the wrong Darrow. So those of you who are history majors, please don't send us an email. I know I caught myself.
Old biology major. I did that.
Yeah. There's all sorts of reasons I know that name. I read about it in a book the other day. That's what it was. Let's try and land this plane here, folks, and talk about. I hesitate to say.
I think it's going down after the Kickstarter comment.
Right. Yeah. Before we have to jump out of this burning plane, let's talk about. I hesitate to say recommendations, but maybe our conclusions, some final thoughts. What relevance does Monopoly still have for us, especially as hobby gamers? Maybe that's maybe a better question to ask than a recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, of course, like none of us are going to, like, really, like, rush out and, like, none of us are going to really tell you, like, yeah, you should absolutely go and play Monopoly because it's this amazing, stunning game. We're always going to recommend other things to you. But it is undeniable that a lot of people who are currently playing board games, who are maybe of our age, had some experience with Monopoly in early years, and that led to, like, an interest in board games, and that led to where we are now. And doing this cast in a way, so there's obviously some influence there. It is an important game to know about. I mean, especially its history, which is absolutely bizarre for what it is. And we've talked a couple of times about how modern board games can be a bit sniffy about those family games that we encounter when we're younger, but they are a stepping stone to different things to other things. So you've got to take those steps at some point, whatever game it is, whether it's Monopoly, whether it's Cluedo, whether it's like, I don't know, whatever. I was lucky enough to like have a parent who had a pen pal in Ravensburger, so I got to see some early like Ravensburger like family games, and they were really much better, but they were not widely available things at all. Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to make some recommendations for you, it's to like try some things that give that Monopoly vibe, I guess, like that sort of like wheeling and dealing vibe. One of my favorite games that we mentioned earlier, Lords of Vegas, does that certainly, and has paper money in it, and has much better sort of negotiation stuff in it. Magnate from Naylor Games, which I have a full copy of that I haven't played, but I previewed a Kickstarter copy of it, which is sort of like got that Monopoly thing to it of buying and selling property, but has a financial crash built into the game, so you have to sort of like push your luck on how much things are worth. That's kind of interesting as well. And I recently played Acquire by Sid Saxon, which has got a sort of Monopoly kind of vibe to it as well, and there's wheeling and dealing, that kind of thing. Those are games I'd recommend over that. My Brainwaves co-host Jamie is not part of this cast, but he is a big fan of Monopoly Deal, which is the little card game version that came out a few years ago, and is apparently not a bad little game at all. So there you go. There's my recommendations for Monopoly-like kind of stuff, and actually one Monopoly game.
I'm going to immediately undermine what Ian said, as is my wont, and say actually I am going to recommend to play Monopoly, because you should play Monopoly if you've never played it, because it is such an enormous cultural stone. Yeah. If you haven't played it, you should play Monopoly because it is such a huge thing, both inside and outside Monopoly. I would add, if you've never played Monopoly by the actual rules, you owe it a chance to play it in that way, because it is better than you think it is. It may not be great, but it is probably not quite as bad as you remember. Otherwise, no, okay, you're good, yeah. And all the stuff that Ian said is all true. But under those two circumstances, I would certainly recommend that you give Monopoly a go.
That's totally fair.
I would say I would agree with Matt for the most part on there, and with Ian, both of you. I would say if you do play it for the first time, find three friends to play it with. Four people's about right. That's about what the game wants. And a game recommendation I would give, you mentioned Acquire, Ian, and Acquire is a lot of fun, but it's really more of a speculation and tile laying game. It has paper money, though, so it's Monopoly. It has paper money, right? But the game I would really recommend by Sid Saxon as well is I'm the Boss, which is a very fun straight negotiation game where you are given a big old fat stack of cash and it tells you have to divide it between these people, who's going to get what, and you have to talk it out. It's a little softer in negotiation because it has a lot of take that cards that allow you to, if you're not much of a negotiator like I am, you can throw a little chaos in it and maybe succeed that way. That's my recommendation if you like that kind of deal making. But if you've never played Monopoly, I think there's maybe three games in the world I would say this about. But if you've never played Monopoly, you definitely owe it to yourself to at least play it once by the rules, as Matt says. Well, that's about all the time we have on this episode of Cult of the Old. As Ian mentioned earlier, we have a lot of sources for this episode. Those will be in our show notes. Yes, Ian?
They will indeed, yep.
And we will see you all next time in a world of laughter and a world of tears. Thank you, everybody. Have a great time.
All the best, folks.
Thanks very much for listening. Editing for the cast was done by me, Ian McAllister. The music for the cast was provided by my brother-in-law, David Dolliver, with my friend, Alistair McLeod. Our logo was created by Rachel Wines-Thrower. If you like what you've listened to, then the best way to help us out is by telling your friends about us and leave us a review and rating on your podcast host of choice. You can follow the hosts on various social media platforms, and we'll put links to all of those in our show notes. You can come and chat to the team and fellow game enthusiasts in our Discord, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do so through our Patreon. Links to both of those will be in the show notes as well. If you'd like to contact us about any of the games we've covered on the cast, should cover, or anything else really, you can contact us at cultoftheolduk@gmail.com. Bye for now.